Is it a spiraling superpower showdown or a glorified trade negotiation? The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken kicking off a three-day visit in China's economic capital, Shanghai, his second trip to China in under a year. Unlike during the Cold War when exchanges between the blocs were, well, anecdotal, today it's the world's two biggest powers at the table, powers whose biggest trading partners happen to be each other. When Washington and Beijing face off over China flooding world markets with subsidized solar panels and electric car batteries, it sure sounds like bartering over big bucks. But there's also competing political models at stake. Blinken's visit comes hours after the U.S. Senate overwhelmingly approved legislation to force the sale of TikTok by China, the addictive video-sharing site whose business model, like that of its U.S. competitors, relies on vacuuming up its users' personal habits, beliefs, and tastes. Beyond the more conventional standoff over fresh military aid to semiconductor-producing Taiwan, how to define this battle over who controls this digital age we live in? How far should the West go? Today in the France 24 debate, this U.S.-China showdown is seen by economist Benjamin Birnbaumer, author in French of China, United States, Capitalism versus Globalization. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
We're pleased to welcome as well André Lauzon-Petry, president of the Joint European Disruptive Initiative, which I could say advocates for tech made in Europe.
Well, it actually finances moonshot research programs for Europe to be back in the race.
All right. Thank you for being with us. From Oxford in England, Una Brzezina Serenkova, director of the Riga Stardins University's China Studies Center. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening, and it's a good company.
And from Washington, Michael Sobolik, senior fellow in Indo-Pacific Studies at the American Foreign Policy Council, the author of Countering China's Great Game, A Strategy for American Dominance. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24Debate. Yeah, Shanghai before Beijing, and Tony Kerrigan has more on Antony Blinken's latest trip to China.
Antony Blinken may already be in diplomatic hot water with China, arriving in Shanghai only hours after Congress rubber-stamped $8 billion of military aid to Taiwan.
Tonight we tell our allies, we stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us.
China has, of course, reacted.
The insertion of Taiwan-related content into the U.S. congressional bill seriously violates the One China principle and the three joint communiques of China and the U.S.
A potentially glacial atmosphere in which to discuss other hot-button issues during Blinken's visit, like Ukraine, amid an apparent tightening of ties between Beijing and Moscow.
I stress that companies, including those in the PRC, must not provide material support for Russia's war, and that they will face significant consequences if they do.
China maintains an officially neutral position and denies any provision of military aid to Russia. And while China bashing was once Donald Trump's turf, election season is bringing out President Biden's toughest anti-Chinese rhetoric yet on trade. Addressing steel workers in Pittsburgh last week, the president mooted a tripling of tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminium and went on to lambast China on every level.
They've got a population that is more people in retirement than working. They're not importing any. They're xenophobic. Nobody coming else coming in. I'm not looking for a fight with China. I'm looking for competition, but fair competition.
This amid fears Chinese competition could also send Biden's clean energy manufacturing plans awry. And soon after, a Gallup poll of U.S. voters placed China public enemy number one. And Chinese officials may have a bone to pick with the Secretary of State on cybersecurity, as a bill just passed says Chinese parent company ByteDance must either sell TikTok to an American owner or see the app banned from the U.S. market. This after Meta apps were pulled from the Chinese App Store last week. On the agenda for Biden's three-day visit, meetings with students and business leaders, as well as his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi.
Why, André Lauzon-Petry, is Antony Blinken in China right now? I mean, we saw in that report Janet Yellen. She was just there, this Treasury Secretary, a couple weeks ago. Why is he there now?
Well, he has two objectives. The U.S. is in this difficult election year, but on the other side, the pressure is mounting between these two giants. First, he needs to exert pressure because China is continuing to provide strong support to Russia, not obviously in direct military terms, even if we don't are not completely sure about that, but in dual-use technologies, electronics, everything which actually is under embargo from the West. And you cannot have on one side China engaging with the rest of the world, needing exports and open markets, and on the other side, obviously supporting the West's enemy number one, which is Russian right now. And on the other side, there are a lot of dossiers, files, where China-US cooperation is needed. There's only one to mention is, for example, the whole cooperation on drugs. Fentanyl is a healthcare issue. I don't know if it's number one, but among the top in the U.S. And the need of Chinese support to cut the producers of precursors, so basic elements for this drug.
For these synthetic drugs.
For these synthetic drugs that are really transforming some of America's downtowns into zombie lands. If you look at San Francisco in particular, it's particularly appalling to see that. So on one side, you need cooperation, and on the other side, the pressure is incredible. The one thing that really strikes me is that the U.S. is using what China has been using for the last 30 years, the carrot and the baton at the same time. You have the pressure with Taiwan, with the bill, obviously, for Ukraine. And on the other side, the carrot is these two visits of Yellen early April and now of Blinken.
It's a carrot because?
Well, because it keeps China as a strong talking partner for the U.S. And I think China today needs this international standing in a context where economically and even strategically, probably the image of China is a little bit less rosy than it used to be a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it seems to be working both ways, Una Berzina-Sarenkova, because you heard in that report the strong language when it comes to military aid for Taiwan by the U.S. We've been talking on this channel about the joint maneuvers between the U.S. and the Philippines in the South China Sea. But it's irritating up to a point. After all, the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet was invited just 2 days ago to a symposium in Qingdao as part of celebrations marking the 75th anniversary of the Chinese People's Liberation Army's naval fleet. So is this all just a bit of theater, or are the tensions real?
I think what we're seeing here is the value of dialogue. That is something that has really come in after last November, after what the Chinese are referring to the San Francisco vision, after that meeting between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden in the U.S. And in fact, China is scrambling to underscore that, you know, the value of dialogue as management. Everybody at this point understands that this is not a tool for improvement of relations. This is a tool for management. And I think your example about Qingdao is a case in point, because especially this dialogue is needed in terms of mill-mill cooperation, right? And actually, I think a great example of this was that some 3 weeks ago, we've also seen the Harvard-based author of Destined for War, Graham Allison, whom all of our undergraduate students always quote on the Thucydides trap, who used to, you know, kind of make the argument that the war is if not inevitable, then highly likely between this sitting hegemon, the U.S., and the rising hegemon, the China, went to Beijing, was invited by Xi Jinping, sat down with him, and, you know, started tweeting about how Xi Jinping listened to him and responded to some of this, not least by a phrase which Allison quoted, which is the description of the U.S.-China relationship as, I am in you, you are in me, so we are kind of inseparable. So I kind of feel like this is the year of, maybe it is a little bit of pageantry, you're right, and it doesn't really bite at the core issues, which you've also outlined, which lay in economics and also lay in security, but it certainly is a reckoning of the need for conversation.
Right, Benjamin Birbaumer, what do the Chinese want?
Well, first of all, I'd say I would not overestimate the value of dialogue, because fundamentally I think that there are diverging interests. What China is looking for is to reorganize the global market according to Chinese standards. And this is fundamentally incompatible with currently existing globalization, which is all about the process under US supervision. And the summary that you just provided shows us that there is disagreement in financial matters, disagreement on commercial matters, disagreement in production, and even, as you just said, there are these military drills between the Philippines and the US. So all of these issues, I think, are not exactly the sign of appeasement. So I think there is quite a mismatch between the official visit and the real challenges going on behind the scene.
And who's got the upper hand?
Well, the thing is, and I think what is worrying the US, is that the US still has the upper hand, but China is catching up quicker and quicker. And this is precisely reason for concern.
Michael Sobolik, is China catching up quicker and quicker when we see its share of the world economy dip sharply since its zero COVID policy? It hasn't gotten back its market share. It's got huge debt issues. It's got, as you heard Joe Biden say in that report, an aging population. Is China really catching up?
I would go a step further, at least for now. Over the next decade or so, China is not only catching up, China is winning the great power competition with the United States. If we go beyond a decade, all of those trends that you just laid out are going to overtake Beijing unless something miraculous happens. And then Xi Jinping and the People's Republic of China are really going to be facing some tough headwinds. But at least today, they are outcompeting the United States, and it's for a simple reason. They acknowledge that Beijing is in a Cold War with America, and American politicians continue to try to play it both ways of competing on one side of the ledger, but also cooperating at the same time. The impact of that is the Biden administration has withheld a lot of competitive actions against Beijing, and they're pulling a lot of their punches, and we aren't competing to win a Cold War. They're competing to try to manage a competition.
And pulling their punches how?
Not interested in that.
How are they pulling their punches?
And so there was a really fascinating report from Reuters that came out last summer. It detailed how the State Department was delaying further sanctions on officials for the genocide of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. They were delaying additional export controls on Huawei, the 5G company, and they were withdrawing or withholding the publication of the report of the spy balloon that sailed over the United States last year. And the reason was simple. They were trying to protect Antony Blinken's first trip to China last year. They cared about making that happen so much that they withheld sanctions and export controls, and they didn't tell the truth to the American public about the spy balloon. It's only one example of several of how the administration is withholding competitive actions because the cooperative side of the ledger is just more important to them.
Of course, the gloves are off now, particularly with the news of the last 24 hours, well, with that Taiwan military aid package also tied to a bill that came out of Congress and was signed by the president this Wednesday that forces the Chinese owners of TikTok to sell the video sharing site. Brian Quinn has more.
TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance now has 9 months to sell its stake or else see the app blocked in the U.S. On this vote, Marco Rubio of Florida, among the 79 senators in favor of the bill.
For years, we've allowed the Chinese Communist Party to control one of the most popular apps in America. That was dangerously short-sighted, but thankfully, we are waking up to the threat China-controlled companies pose to America.
At roughly 170 million monthly users, the U.S. is far from TikTok's biggest market by population, but it is the world's most lucrative for social media firms due to the country's abundance of deep-pocketed advertisers and coveted consumers. Being forced out could even jeopardize TikTok's revenues worldwide, with advertisers focusing on other networks as they craft global marketing strategies. It would also scuttle the company's plan to grow TikTok's U.S. e-commerce operations by a factor of 10 this year alone. A ban would likely benefit TikTok's main rival, Meta, whose Instagram app features a competing platform called Reels. ByteDance has already spent big in an unsuccessful effort to prevent the bill's passage, $7 million in 2024 alone on lobbying and ad campaigns. It will now be spending big on a courtroom battle, likely based on free speech arguments that have helped it to defeat past attempts to ban TikTok. Should the company yield and try to find a buyer, there's no guarantee of finding one who can afford it. ByteDance overall is worth an estimated $225 billion, with its U.S. operations likely to cost tens of billions.
And André de Zucker-Pietri, ByteDance confirming that it is taking this to court and that they will fight it in the courts. I note as well that the Biden campaign is staying on TikTok their candidate bids for a re-election in November. Where is this going to go?
Well, you know, that's the Stockholm syndrome, is you hate something, but you get in love with those who are making you prisoners. So we have also a lot of European leaders who are now getting onto TikTok. So it's incredible. I mean, despite the fact that...
Including the President of France and the Chancellor of Germany.
Absolutely. And, I can't help being fascinated by the strategic approach that the U.S. is taking. I would disagree with the fact that China is winning. I think there is obviously an interest, a bipartisan interest in the U.S. to have a common enemy, and that is actually putting the country together. It's one of the few things that still unites the two sides of the aisle, is the opposition to China, and it has some benefits. I think China is in a situation which is much darker than it used to be. I mean, for the first time, you mentioned it, the share in global GDP went down. I mean, we always thought that it would only go up forever. That is not happening. Industrial prices went down by 5 to 10% in some cases, which is an issue short term for our industry because it's kind of crowding out the European and the U.S. Industrial makers. I think the naivety we have in Europe on that is incredible.
So what you're saying, when China ails, it also makes the rest of the world ill.
Absolutely. And this is what makes, for example, we just had the Chancellor Scholz visit to China, which was a total disaster because he didn't achieve anything. I mean, he's still in this 20th century mentality where you think that you can negotiate something. The only way, apparently, that this might work is not in a conflictual situation. It's in a tough dialogue, like the previous speaker mentioned, a dialogue, but a tough dialogue. I mean, you have this couple of billions for Taiwan. You have this TikTok ban. That's the only way probably Blinken is going to achieve something.
So the ban is justified.
I think the ban is totally justified. I mean, beyond the fact that I think democracies have been very naive compared to the societal impact these social media have on our democratic systems. I think we always get it into free speech, but we also need to see the damage it's bringing. On top of that, we know now how AI can capture information about personal information, behavior, and we have entered, I mean, NATO is calling that the cognitive warfare. We are in an area where you can influence not only individuals, but also whole societies through these kind of social media. I'm less worried when it's independent owners, shareholders, financial owners. I'm worried, but I'm very worried when there is a risk that can go and be used by a sovereign state, which obviously is in a strategic competition to democracies.
All right, so on the social medium that he now owns, Elon Musk a few days ago tweeting that, in my opinion, TikTok should not be banned in the United States, even though such a ban may benefit the X platform, doing so would be contrary to freedom of speech and expression. It is not what America stands for. Michael Sobolik, you agree?
Not a bit. Elon Musk has a history of repeating talking points of Beijing. He's done this on the Uyghur genocide. He has done this on Taiwan, and now he's doing it on TikTok. So I'm not surprised at all that Elon Musk opposes this. But on the issue more broadly with competition, the reason that China has the upper hand against, at least against the United States right now, and I make this point definitively in Countering China's Great Game, we can tackle TikTok, we can tackle issues of slave-tainted imports from the genocide in Xinjiang, which Washington has done, and Europe has taken steps to do that as well in a piecemeal way. But that's reacting to problems that Beijing has created for democracies. You win a Cold War not only by playing good defense, but you got to play good offense. And in the prior Cold War against the Soviet Union, America and the West, we were at our strongest when we identified the weaknesses of our adversary and exploited them.
But haven't Meta, let me just ask you this, haven't Meta and Twitter, now X, also facilitated the spread of disinformation? Why is it any different?
So you are getting into something that's really essential here. With these Western social media companies, there's actually a real private market in the United States. Those companies are not controlled by the U.S. government in any way. But you are correct in that disinformation and misinformation has absolutely been advanced on those platforms, but not at the behest of the U.S. government. That's what makes TikTok separate. That's what makes it unique. It is controlled. It's owned by a Chinese parent company, ByteDance. Because it's domiciled in China, it must answer to the Chinese Communist Party under China's own laws. So the leverage there is unique. And it's the FBI director just talked about this last night, actually. It's a real threat of Beijing controlling this app.
Una Brezina Serenkova, you agree?
Well, we do know that, of course, the national security law can trigger information transfers to the Ministry of State Security and other Chinese organs. So in that sense, indeed, TikTok is in a separate position, a different position in a different weight group, let's say. But of course, we've seen also that the EU has, I mean, it's not just a U.S. approach. We've also seen last year, I think it was at least it was winter. I don't remember which month exactly, but the commission had launched an inquiry into TikTok looking at data protection. Now we have this whole scandal around TikTok Lite, right, which apparently is a way how people are getting linked into TikTok by getting some cents for scrolling. So the endless scroll becomes even more addictive once you feel like you're getting tokens for it. So in that sense, it feels like the EU is going after issue-based TikTok behavior, but it still is going after TikTok behavior as well. So the story is wider than just the U.S.
It's wider than just the U.S. And let's just give an update here, Una. TikTok Lite, which has been pulled from Europe by ByteDance, this after on Monday, the European Commission said that ByteDance had been suspected of being toxic and addictive, particularly for children. Just to remind our viewers, its key feature is a reward program that allows users to earn points while performing certain tasks on the platform, such as watching videos, liking content, following creators, or inviting friends to join. Even more addictive than, I guess you could call it, regular TikTok. So they're backing down when it comes to Europe, Una. But what about this question of whether or not disinformation and the addiction to social media and the ravages it may cause, is it any different whether it's called TikTok or Instagram or whatever?
The underlying phenomenon, which is a society-based phenomenon, is not different. But I would agree with the previous speaker that we are looking at the actor. So the EU is using this new acronym FIMI, Foreign Information Manipulation and Interference, to set this group of information manipulation apart, which is when it is done at the behest of a hostile state actor with the goal to destabilize a democratic society. And that is the big threat. So, of course, disinformation. We know every time we turn on YouTube, we know that we will be bombarded with ads, which are not necessarily true. But at the same time, it's a whole different ballgame when this comes as a targeted activity performed by a hostile state-level actor.
And are there concrete examples of that?
Well, we had some election interference examples, and we've also had some networks, wider networks, spreading, posing as different websites, as news websites. So in that sense, yes, the other big, and they have been tied to MSS by my colleagues. The other big thing, of course, is how easily can we attribute? But I believe that many of my colleagues have attributed either beyond a shadow of doubt or with a very, very slow and insignificant shadow of doubt. We can say that there is this process going on. Is it the same as Russia? No, China is not the same actor as Russia in the scope of its FIMI activities. Is it learning? Apparently it is.
Benjamin Birbaumer, just to clarify on this, it's not actually a ban on TikTok. They're saying you have to sell TikTok.
Indeed, there is a competition.
So sell it to who? We suspect to Americans, right?
Probably. So there is indeed a battle for market shares on the U.S. market. But I think what is even behind all of these discussions is the battle for artificial intelligence. Because as you know, AI feeds on data. And, well, if you cut TikTok or ByteDance from 170 million US data, US users, that's also less data for the development of artificial intelligence. And only recently,
because every time we post a video or we comment on a post, we're feeding the beast when it comes to AI.
Exactly. And only recently, only last week, I think, Stanford University published its Artificial Intelligence Index report showing that the US is still leader in the development of AI models. But when it comes to the industrial application, in this area, China is way ahead of the US. So the Chinese know how to use artificial intelligence, even if they do not know how to develop the most performing, highest performing models. And this is, of course, a huge issue, because what stands out for US multinational corporations is that they control technology that allows them to lead global value chains. And once Chinese multinational corporations reach that level of technologies, well, they become a direct threat to U.S. corporations.
I know you have to leave soon. So Andrei Lizakovich has to leave us early for a charity event. So, but just a quick question. This whole debate over TikTok, it speaks to the question of how good or not the Chinese are when it comes to soft power. Are they getting better?
Well, they're definitely getting better. They understand that data that has been mentioned is the new oil. And I remember it's not just about posting information on TikTok. It's each time you like or dislike something, you actually give a lot of information about your preferences, about what is going to make you tick, is what is going to appeal to you or dislike you. It's a huge political impact that it has. So I think these kind of soft power through supporting these companies is very smart. I think the fact that the dialogue channels are still open, that the fact that Blinken will probably get some kind of a good welcome is not because suddenly the Chinese have become more soft, but they understand that that's a way also to appear. So we are very far from the lonely wolf strategy from these ambassadors who were like shouting at everybody, especially the one that we have here in Paris, that I think was a disaster for Chinese image globally. So I think, yes, the Chinese are learning. I think they're learning, but I think the U.S. Is still ahead. My biggest concern is that Europe is not that we are not good, but we lack strategic understanding. We don't know where we want to go.
And the Chinese president, he's coming to Paris in just a couple of weeks' time.
Yes.
What should the French president be telling him, in public and in private?
Well, hopefully, I'm not a diplomat, but I think that especially with China, it's very important to have the same language publicly and privately, because otherwise it kicks back if you have these differences.
And that's what you're saying the German chancellor didn't do?
Well, I think the German chancellor, he is completely stuck into two contradictory mindsets. He has on one side part of his industry who is so dependent now on China that they are, I mean, we are in this typically Stockholm syndrome. Some of the big automakers or some of the big chemical companies, they are lost if they don't have the Chinese market. And they now realize how dependent they are on that. They even cut jobs today in Germany to implement their factories in China, which is kind of a strategic, I think, very short-sighted approach. And on the other side, I mean, we just had a couple of spying cases in Germany, which really shows that actually Germany is not that kind of a friend, is also a target for espionage, for trade confrontation in the hardest way. So I think we need clarity, and we need we don't need confrontation, but we need to know where we want to go. And I don't think the Europeans are there. And I hope President Macron will have a much clearer message.
But the same message in public as in private. You say, André Lezoukou-Petri, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate. Now, the question is not just TikTok. In the shadow of the, pardon the pun, this row, subsidized Chinese solar panels have been flooding world markets. Just last week, Cubic PV, that's a Massachusetts-based company which manufactures components for solar panels, announced it couldn't compete and would forego construction of a $1.4 billion factory. Also last week, the only company that produces solar panels in France was forced to call it quits and lay off its 90 employees. Benjamin Birbaumer, this flooding of the market, is that a sign of China's strength or weakness?
Well, the thing is actually, what is striking is that China has overcapacities or has had overcapacities for the last 20 years. And actually, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, nobody bothered about this because China was exporting low value added goods. Now that China has caught up and is exporting solar panels and things like this, everybody's getting afraid. But it looks like those that promoted globalization somehow wake up and consider that now globalization is bad. So I'm still a bit confused about this kind of reactions. What is sure is that the Chinese economy has a huge disequilibrium between consumption and investment. And this is what comes to Europe, what comes to the US in the shape of oversupply. So it is both a weakness of the Chinese economy, but still, if you look at the last quarter growth reports of the Chinese economy is still growing quite fast. But indeed, you need to take into account that it is growing because it is exporting oversupply to the rest of the world.
Yeah, we mentioned Elon Musk earlier. Michael Sobolik, it's not been a great week for Tesla. The layoff of employees, cutting prices on some of its models. But its Chinese competitors aren't doing well either with this overcapacity issue. What do you make of this flooding the market? Have the Chinese overstretched, or is this part of the plan?
Xi Jinping is in a tough position on this because the very thing that is allowing Beijing to outcompete global firms, which is overproduction and dumping, is also the thing that is preventing the Chinese economy from escaping the middle income trap. Right now, the Chinese Communist Party is demanding what it has always demanded over the Chinese economy since 1949, which is complete control. And sure, that's ebbed and flowed in terms of market liberalization in one era versus another. But what has been constant is that there's never been a purely free market inside of China. It's been controlled. And competition has been controlled. And the state decides who wins and who loses. And that does allow Chinese companies in strategic sectors to dominate. We've seen that in 5G. We've seen that in biotechnology. We've seen that in electric car vehicle batteries. We've seen it in solar panels. So it's good for China in the short run. But in the long run, that insistence on control is going to exacerbate the disequilibrium that the previous speaker just mentioned. And it's a really tough position politically and economically for China. And I don't know how they're going to get around it.
And sitting where you are today, Una Berzina Serenkova in the UK, what's your view on that, on where we're headed when it comes to what are such essential components of an economy that's changing?
Well, I would like to echo that, of course, solar panels are viewed in the EU and also in the UK as a lost battle and also as a cautionary tale. I think the EVs are now the next industry that is like don't let this happen kind of a mindset. And of course, what is driving these subsidies in China? And this idea, the overcapacity issue was already mentioned. And I would like to remind that I am from Latvia, and 10 years ago, we have a metallurgical plant go out of business against the backdrop of Chinese global steel and aluminum overcapacity. So that was also something we were all facing. I'm sure we were not the only ones. So the one thing is overcapacity. But the other thing, of course, is the drive, the ambition to claim global markets, the going out policy. So that is also a significant psychological element to this. And I think that the EU, and sorry if I'm not, you know, I still see the UK as part of a bigger picture and always as a part of EU's reckoning as well. But for the EU, last year, 2023, has certainly been a year of owing up to an industrial policy, finally saying that to not repeat the solar panel story, which had unfair sort of putting a finger on the scale on the side of the Chinese government, we need to do something. And the EU introduced the de-risking language, said that this is, you know, we need to de-risk. The EU began to voice the issues of trade and economy directly with China, and the Commission launched the investigation on subsidized electric cars from China, right? And the premise, of course, when the EU switched to this very clear de-risking language, that's late, the idea was that this would go down better in Beijing than the previous approach, which had been the partner-competitor rival trifecta, because everybody thought, oh, that's what the Chinese are doing also. They're also de-risking, so they will understand. The assessment was incorrect, and the de-risking remains to be a trigger for China. Yeah, but it's definitely a change in the mindset for us.
A change in the mindset, you say. But again, let's look at the images of the last week. You have you're asking, is the European Union speaking with one voice? We have on Tuesday, and we had earlier Michael alluding to it, the European Parliament overwhelmingly approving a measure that bans imports of products made with forced labor. The law doesn't directly mention China, but many lawmakers hope it will be used to block imports involving Xinjiang, where many Uyghur Muslims have been parked in labor camps. 95% of solar panels worldwide, for instance, are made up of polysilicon, half of which is produced in Xinjiang. But, and we talked about this earlier, Una, history doesn't say if the German chancellor brought that up when he toured China 10 days ago. Here you see him at a Bosch hydrogen fuel cell plant in Chongqing. Or, again, whether Emmanuel Macron will actually talk human rights when Xi Jinping is privately in a room with him in Paris.
So that's the beauty of the EU, that you can have the voice from Brussels, but also the national level leaders tend to more or less confirm to the bottom line, but sometimes sort of go out on a limb or, you know, say, oh, but we need to do something for our industries. I think that's been outlined today in the show as well when it comes to the German car makers. At the end of the day, I believe that Scholz's visit did contain a very strong, well, no, not a very strong, a sufficiently strong message on China's tacit support to Russia vis-a-vis Russia's invasion in Ukraine. So an important, at least it's important that it's being stressed. It also contained the same issue, the same de-risking narrative. And by the way, China reacted, and in the response, in the Chinese readout, you see that Wang Yi, or was it Xi Jinping? Sorry, one of the leaders said, well, what's there to de-risk? There is no risk in our bilateral relationship. This means that Scholz did pick up the de-risking thread after all. So there is no shared voice in the EU, but there is a certain common understanding. And I think 2023 has brought us closer to that. Let's see what the next year brings. Let's see how the European elections go. I think we are in a more stable position than the US, but at the end of the day, still, there could be some changes. So let's not get complacent with this.
Benjamin Birbaumer, is the EU in a more stable position when it comes to handling China?
The problem of the European Union is that it lacks something that is very important in China and increasingly important in the US, which is industrial policy. There is a need to steer the economy towards the most important, the most cutting-edge sectors, such as solar panels, electrical vehicles. So this is precisely what the EU has not done throughout the last decades, and therefore it finds itself...
So what's a bigger wake-up call? Is it the Chinese dumping, or is it when the United States does its own industrial policy subsidy program with Joe Biden's Inflation Recovery Act?
I mean,
Reduction Act.
U.S. industrial policy has been a long-standing issue existing for over decades, but still, I think with the Biden administration, there has been some triggering effect in Europe, but still it has not really... it did not get to the brains of European decision makers because there's still no industrial policy whatsoever. The US, the European Union, has basically throughout the last decade been subsidizing underperforming firms and therefore is now in the very uncomfortable situation of being dependent on US or Chinese technologies. And this, of course, in the long run, cannot work out.
Michael Sobolik, again, top of the agenda, both for Antony Blinken and for Emmanuel Macron, is telling the Chinese to lessen, if not sever, ties to Russia. But that's at this particular point in time. We've talked about a return to the Cold War. Of course, what we're talking about this whole hour has nothing to do with the Cold War, again, since the economies are so interdependent. Is that interdependence a good thing or a bad thing?
On balance, the economically, for the past 3.5 decades, it's been great for the global consumer. But I think we're learning today that that's come with the cost, a security cost. And we're just now beginning to feel it as the world order is shifting and being tested. I do think the interdependence is central to this Cold War that we're in because it has built Beijing into the economic juggernaut that it is today. And they've leveraged that economic wealth to marshal a strategy to secure the world that the Chinese Communist Party wants to live in. And that comes at the expense of democracies on both sides of the Atlantic. And Secretary Blinken can say all he wants to say to his Chinese counterparts, and the Biden administration has said a lot. Talk is one thing, but talk is cheap. And that's always been the case, and it remains so today, especially in a Cold War. If the United States is going to win this competition with our allies and our partners around the world for freedom, then we need to go on the offensive. And that means doing more than just diplomatic missions and trying to convince an arm tug Beijing to not do something we don't want it to do. We need to compel the Chinese Communist Party to stop threatening democracies in America and throughout Europe. And we do that by taking competitive actions that target the weaknesses of the CCP's political regime.
We'll have to leave it there. So much more to talk about. I want to thank you, Michael Sobolik, for joining us from Washington. Una Brzezina Sarankova in Oxford. Benjamin Birnbaumer for being with us here. Thank you for joining us here in the France 24 debate.